station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. You know, I believe America is in the greatest jeopardy it's ever been. And I believe if there's any hope of saving this country for generations yet unborn, we've got to get back to the fundamentals. And so many years ago, we put together a 10-point program of what the average individual can do, because the average individual out there really has a feeling of frustration. I mean, you know, how are we going to stand up against anything as powerful as what you described? And so point number one, of course, is if you are going to be involved in this battle for the survival of Western civilization, you have to have a personal relationship with our Lord, because you get into this and you are not solidly founded in this belief in our Lord Jesus Christ, you will come up against spiritual forces that will destroy you. And I've talked to person after person who's actually had their lives destroyed and their families destroyed because they've gotten involved in this battle. And so, first of all, you have to have really a supernatural protection before you enter it. But number two is you have to understand our Constitution and why the American Constitution is unique and different and why America is worthwhile trying to save. And so with that as a background, why this evening we have with us Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution, and the Institute does help Radio Liberty stay on the air, and we enjoy very much having Pastor Whitney with us as we go step by step through the Constitution. And actually, we do this about every year or 2 years, and right now we're back in the early parts of the Constitution. But repetition is important, and we're really trying to teach, and that's what Pastor Whitney's trying to do. And so without further ado, Pastor David Whitney, how are you tonight, David?
Great, Dr. Stan. Thank you again for having us on the program, and it's a privilege to speak with your audience and to know that as we communicate these truths, this, as you said, is the hope that we can take our nation back from those tyrants, really, those who do not believe in the principles of freedom and liberty that our founders enshrined in the three foundational documents that every American should know inside and out. That's the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, because if we don't know those, we cannot keep our government honest to the contract, really, that we have with our government. And that contract is those three documents. That's what government's job description is. And when government does not do its function, and when it fails, when it violates the job description, it is we, the people, that must hold our government accountable for its violations and must remove those from office who are the violators of this contract, our Constitution, and put people in their place who will uphold and fulfill that exact agreement that we the people are the ones who created our government. We brought it into existence. We gave it delegated, enumerated powers. And we the people are the ones who have to be, in a sense, the policemen on our civil government to be sure that they fulfill what their duty is and that they do not overstep the bounds that our Constitution has placed upon them. I like what James Madison said in a piece he wrote in the National Gazette. This is January 1792. He said, "Every word of the Constitution decides a question between power and liberty."
And that's really what it's all about. You cannot be free unless you limit the power of government. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, so pick up the story there, David.
We've been looking in the past month at Article 1, Section 8, one of the most important parts of the Constitution, one of the parts that needs to be understood by every American, because this is the section of the Constitution that speaks of the powers that we the people have delegated, that is, it's power that we had, the rights that we had, that we have delegated to our national or our federal government. And it's the powers of Congress, and they're listed here in Article 1, Section 8. There's only 18 things that we have empowered our federal government to do. This is a limitation list. That is, only what's on this list can the federal government rightly do. If it's not on the list, they have no power, no authority to do it. If they do it, they are violating the terms of this contract, our Constitution, and they're violating their oath of office. Every federal official, elected or appointed, takes an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. And that oath really is not a promise made to the people who elected him or the people he represents. Instead, it's an oath made before Almighty God. And I fear for so many of our elected officials because they're going to have a lot to answer on Judgment Day when they stand before Almighty God and he reviews their life, particularly the point at which they took an oath, a solemn vow before Almighty God to do something, and then they did the exact opposite of what they promised God they would do. God's not going to deal with them in any easy fashion unless they repent of that evil of breaking their oath before God. Well, we've talked about several of the first elements of the powers granted to Congress there, to tax and spend only for the payment of debts, only for the common defense, and only for the general welfare. General implies everybody is going to benefit, not specific groups or individuals or socioeconomic groups, that sort of thing, or, you know, victims of Katrina or anything like that. No, none of that. It had to be the entire country would benefit. The second power granted to Congress is to borrow money. The third was to regulate commerce with foreign nations, with Indian tribes, which were basically considered foreign nations, and then among the several states, what's called interstate, that is between states commerce, not intrastate, that is commerce within the state itself. The fourth power granted is to make rules for naturalization, rules also for bankruptcy. The fifth power we talked about was the power to coin money and regulate the money value and fix weights and measures. And this is a very important power. One of the lessons learned during the era of the Articles of Confederation, which basically was from the signing of the Declaration, just within a year, the Articles of Confederation were begun to be put into effect and ratified by a number of states.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Arthur Stan, and Pastor Whitney was basically talking about the things that are laid out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and these are the things that the government would be able to do. And there are only 18 things that they could do, and they were very specifically listed there, and if you don't have a copy of the Constitution, you need to get one. You can get a very economical little copies of the Constitution, and they certainly list the whole thing, and you should have it and read it. You should understand it word for word. Understand the limitations that were placed on our elected representatives, and then note how they are consistently violating their oaths of office, and that's why America is in such jeopardy today. We have men who have sworn an oath before Almighty God, and then have consistently violated. So pick up the story there, David.
So as we were mentioning before the break, that they have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And the reason this was granted to the federal government, that during the era of the Articles of Confederation, each state, all 13 states, had the power to print their own money, fiat currency, backed by nothing at all. And it was a tremendous economic disaster. And also the federal government was printing money, and they printed things called continentals. And may have heard the phrase worthless as a continental. Now, that doesn't refer to the automobile. It refers to the fiat currency issued during the era of the Articles of Confederation that quickly became recognized by merchants and people as worthless paper. They said, no, give me real money. Give me gold and silver. I don't want that worthless paper you're trying to pass off as money. It's not money at all. And inflation, there was a number of disasters that happened with currency, fiat currency not connected with anything of tangible value, such as gold and silver. And so our founder said, that we don't want to repeat that disaster. We don't want each state issuing its own standard of currency and that kind of confusion. So you got one currency from Virginia, another one from, you know, Pennsylvania, and it's just a hodgepodge. We need a consistency between the states, and that consistency can be brought by giving Congress the power to coin money. And, of course, money, constitutional money, you study the details here, only gold and silver are constitutional money. That piece of paper in your wallet that you think is a piece of money is actually, if you look closely, it says Federal Reserve Note. It's not backed any longer since the 60s, not backed by any thing of value, not backed by gold or silver as it was up until, well, I guess it was Nixon who finally closed the redemption window for international traders even. But anyway, constitutional money was gold and silver, and we have rejected and gone away from that standard, and the result is inflation. Most people have come to accept inflation. Well, it's just part of life. You know, everything costs more next year than it was this year and the year after that and so on, and all the values of our houses go up, so people think, oh, this is a great thing. You know, I'm wealthier than I was before. But that's a shell game. What really is happening, the value of your house is not increasing. The value of the dollar by which your house's value is measured is being diluted that rapidly. So the increase you think in price, not really an increase at all. It means that piece of paper called a Federal Reserve note is being devalued at the rapid rate, and that's represented by an increase in the price of something of real tangible value, like a piece of property or a home. And so this was a power granted to Congress because of some of the disasters that took place during the Articles of Confederation. Alongside that is number six, the power that Congress had to punish counterfeiting. If somebody came up with ways of devaluing the money and presenting it as the real thing. So you take a silver coin, instead of it being 90% silver, which all of our coins were except the copper pennies and nickels, all the other coins, quarters and dimes, were 90% silver up until 1964. And at that point, the federal government actually broke its own rule here, and it became the counterfeiter. That the silver content of the coins was no longer 90%. They devalued, they took the value out of the coins, and yet it was their job to punish that kind of activity. And so here you have the fox guarding the hen house, and taking a full helping of whatever it chooses out of the hen house, and the hen house, unfortunately, is we the people, and we pay for it in the hidden tax of inflation and so on. In many ways, we're paying dearly for our government plundering the wealth of this country and stealing it from the individual citizens.
Yeah, I think it's really very interesting. Of course, it was in 64 that they took the 90% silver out. They replaced it with 40% silver, and then a couple of years later, they went to essentially no silver. Well, what people don't remember is that this was during the Vietnam War. And, of course, what they were doing was trying to pay for the war and trying to create the Great Society and all of these wonderful welfare programs, which the federal government had no right to undertake, because what it basically did was bring everybody under the federal government, make them dependent upon the federal government, looking to the federal government. They said we could have guns and butter. They said we can have this wonderful utopian society and not pay for it. And, of course, then in the process of doing that, they didn't want to raise taxes because that would get everybody mad. And so this then began this gradual inflationary cycle that ended, first of all, when they went ahead and devalued and took the gold completely from our dollar on the 15th of August, 1971. And then, of course, we really took off into an inflationary spiral after that, to the point where by 1980, they had to actually raise the interest rates to 21% or 22% to keep inflation from completely destroying our monetary system. And then we began to build after that, of course, after they called it the Reagan recession. It had nothing to do with Ronald Reagan. It was all engineered by the Federal Reserve System, this central bank that controls the destiny of our nation, that's brought us to the sorry state where we are today. And the entire world is on the brink of financial chaos. And, you know, as they begin now to begin to cut back on this inflationary spiral, why so many people are going to lose their life savings, everything they've worked their whole life to get. And it all goes back to the fact we've violated the Constitution originally, which said our money was to be gold and silver.
And that sound money policy was followed, you know, for 150 years, and there were some deviations from it in the 19th century, and then a return to it. And then, of course, major deviations beginning in the 20th century with the creation of the Federal Reserve and so on. So it's interesting that here the very rules that Congress was to uphold by punishing counterfeiting, they themselves violated those rules. But the American people by that time, by the 60s and 70s, had forgotten and had or not been taught what the Constitution actually said, not been taught what their role was to hold their elected officials accountable to the standard of the Constitution. So the people who were supposed to keep the elected officials in check were asleep or ignorant, and therefore they got away with it. And while we talk about them punishing counterfeiting, we ought to mention that the federal government only has three powers granted by the Constitution for police action. That is, to take action against citizens or even non-citizens. There's only three powers. One of them is this one here, the sixth part of the Article 1, Section 8, punishing counterfeiting. But also in the Article 1, Section 8 is the power to punish piracy on the high seas. And this is actually number 10, define and punish piracy and felonies on the high seas. And this was determined that this would be the best place to put that power rather than in the power of the states, because when you're dealing with what takes place on the high seas, it's very hard to have 13 states with perhaps 13 different standards of what is piracy and how do you punish piracy and what part of the ocean is controlled by Massachusetts versus South Carolina. And all those questions make it very difficult for 13 individual states to have this power to punish piracy on the high seas. So it made sense that that power would be granted, delegated by the states, which really held that power initially, delegated by the states to the federal government that they, the states, were forming. Now, the third power, police power, that the is granted to the federal government is to punish treason. That is, those who are seeking to destroy the structure of government that it was put into place in the 13 individual states and their state constitutions, and then, of course, in the federal constitution here that we're studying right now. And so, basically, to punish those enemies who were domestic enemies. We're going to talk a bit about foreign enemies when we talk about the powers of war granted to Congress, but domestic enemies who would seek to destroy our country from within by treason. And they had, you know, some experience with those kind of treasonous characters, even in the War for Independence. We think of Aaron Burr, who was a high official in the Army, who was selling out to the British and absconding with goods that were needed for the troops and selling them on the black market, all kinds of evil things he was doing that were treasonous, and ultimately he was caught for those treasonous actions. But today, as you've already mentioned, Dr. Stan, the biggest traitors and the actions of treason that are most often practiced in our country are those of our own elected officials who are acting in ways to destroy this constitutional republic, to violate the terms of their oath of office, to violate the very purpose for which our Constitution was put into place. These actions are treasonous, and it is the duty of the federal government and those officials in the government to punish those treasonous actions, and when they do not, they are failing to do their duty, they are failing to defend us against our own domestic enemies in our land. And the result of that is that the tyranny is growing and gaining in great power, and we the people are losing the guarantees that were built into the Constitution for our liberties. So those are the only three police powers that the federal government has granted: punish treason, punish counterfeiting, and punish piracy on the high seas. All the other police actions of our federal government at this point in time are unconstitutional and should be stopped immediately.
And we're going to be back in just a moment. I would simply point out that those people who support a world government, who support globalism, who are doing everything they can to transfer our jobs and our factories and our wealth overseas, they have a different loyalty. They have a loyalty to a world government, not to the American government. And they would destroy our Constitution. They would destroy our sovereignty. And those people are working in the leadership of both political parties. Understand that globalism and Americanism are incompatible. And yet, of course, leaders of both parties support them. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney. David, pick up the story.
Well, speaking about the police powers that the federal government has, the only three, that is punish counterfeiting, punish piracy on the high seas, and also punish treason, it means that all the other action that we see day by day from the federal government is unconstitutional. Almost all of the FBI is involved in unconstitutional. Almost all the other regulatory agencies, we think of the BATF, and I guess now it's BATFE for explosives. That whole agency, as well as their police powers, are unconstitutional. The EPA, OSHA. I mean, you just go down through a whole laundry list of these alphabet agencies of the federal government, and they're unconstitutional in their police powers. And yet, day by day, they harass the American citizenry. They destroy businesses time and time again with their regulatory fines and powers. And on, of course, I should mention the IRS, another one that's been granted vast police powers, completely unconstitutional, and I liken it to what one writer has called them, the federal mafia. I think maybe an apt description for their activities, because they are so blatantly unconstitutional. All of those actions are unconstitutional, and if Congress was doing its job, they would close down every one of those agencies. They would strip them of any police powers whatsoever. The police power belongs, in our founders' design, at the lowest level of government, down where we the people had the greatest influence, and that is the county sheriff. That the county sheriff was granted the greatest police power in our country is known from common law, that traces its roots all the way back into English common law, where the sheriff was the most powerful enforcer of the law in a locality. And if the sheriffs of our country today, and I know there's some sheriffs around the country who understand this and are fighting against the FBI's illegal actions in their county or the IRS's illegal seizures and so on, and we pray that there would be more sheriffs who would come forward, or new sheriffs that would come into play who would understand their role and understand that they can defend against an out-of-control, unconstitutional federal government in its actions against we, the people. Well, in addition to punishing counterfeiting, and the next one in the list is seven, is to establish post offices and post roads. And again, when we think about this power, we need to remember every word of the Constitution either grants some power and decides a question between power and liberty. Up to this point in time, up to the time that the Constitution was ratified, the postal system was kind of very chaotic. It was almost completely privatized, and there was no assurance that the letters you sent would actually be received, because if there was one system in one state and another system in another state, if you were trying to send a mail item to another state, it may never get there because the two systems may not at all coordinate. It made a great deal of difficulty, and they recognized it would be wise for the states to grant and delegate this power to the federal government. Again, we need to understand the action taking place here. These are the 13 states coming together saying, we have been granted powers by our own people. Our form of government, we the people, have formed the state government. Now, the state governments here are coming together in the Constitutional Convention and basically saying, we are going to take...
Hold that off right there. Mm-hmm. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and David was pointing out that basically the people had constituted the states. The states then had come together to constitute the Constitution. And so basically the states were granting to the federal government certain rights over them, but those rights were to be restricted by the change of the Constitution because the people did not trust government. They did not trust their own state governments, and the state governments didn't trust the federal government. And it was this belief that men were inherently evil, could not be trusted with power, else it'd be misused, that was the very foundation upon which this country was based. Our founding fathers realized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, that tyranny and total government were synonymous, and as Thomas Jefferson said so well, in matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. And then, of course, John Locke had said, that government governs best, it governs the least. And that was the basic philosophy of the foundation of our country, and why for 150 years the American people were free, and our system of government was the envy of people all throughout the world. So pick up the story there, David.
And so when we realized that the states were granting and delegating certain powers to the federal government, that they were very jealous not to grant any more powers than were absolutely necessary. And we're going to see that in the 10th Amendment of the Bill of Rights, that you know, the states retain all the powers that were not specifically delegated to the federal government. I think it's Federalist 45 that says that the design was that the states would have broad-ranging, wide-reaching powers, and the federal government would have very limited, delegated, enumerated powers. And the post offices and post roads were one of those where the states, as they came together, say, you know, it would be wise to have a system by which if I mail something from New England to South Carolina, it would arrive there in a timely fashion because the post office system has been established and post roads have been established and there's a smooth operation there. And the question here, because the text of the Constitution says establish post offices and post roads. I mean, set the structure up and set it going, but it doesn't necessarily mean maintain them. And so the question is, when they set them up and get them started going, is it the job of the federal government to continue to maintain them? It doesn't state that that is what the Constitution is granting power to the federal government. It's just the power to establish the structure under which those are going to be established and operate smoothly. So again, you could even look at post offices and post roads as something that there's been a stretching of the meaning of that term in how it's being handled today. Well, number 8 in the list of 18 is to establish rules for copyrights and patents. And this really comes back to our founders' firm understanding of God's law. God's law says, thou shalt not steal. Property rights are sacred. John Adams spoke of property rights as being sacred. And they recognized that property rights not only meant the piece of land you owned or a house you owned, but the tools of your business. Those also were property, and there was intellectual property. That is, if you wrote a book, the thoughts and research that you put into that writing, you owned that. That was your property. It was the production of your labor that brought that into being. And likewise, if you invented a piece of machinery, that it was your inventive design, it was your research, it was your painstaking development of this piece of machinery, that is your property, your work that needs to be protected from theft, and therefore copyrights and patents should be established. And again, it made sense for the states to grant this power to the federal government rather than having 13 different sets of copyright laws and patent laws, which means if you were an inventor and you'd have to go to 13 different state capitals and 13 different sets of rules, it would just be very difficult. And actually, when you look at the amazing explosion that took place in the 19th century of inventions in America, because America was a place where it was much easier to protect your intellectual property than most of Europe. Europe had a hodgepodge of legislation and rules, and it was very difficult for someone to protect their property there, intellectual property. But here in America, it was very easy. Therefore, people who were inventors, people who were researchers and wanted to protect the work that they wrote, often they would come to America because they recognized in America their rights would be protected by our form of government. Their property would be protected.
Today, we left off. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Go right ahead. You got about 30 seconds.
Okay, yet today our property rights are being attacked by the federal government. The Supreme Court saying that a government agency can steal your property if they can get more tax revenue out of your property than you will yield to them. And that's an evil, evil thing, contrary to the design of our founders.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And, of course, what we try to do with these programs is to ingrain in you an understanding of the basic fundamentals of the Constitution. If we were to say one thing, we would say the Constitution limits the power of government, takes its chains off of the people, and puts it onto the politicians. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Pastor David Whitney. Go ahead, pick up the story there, David.
Well, that's number, we just mentioned number 8, establish rules for copyright and patents. Number 9 on the list is to establish federal courts below the Supreme Court. That is the power granted to Congress. Congress has complete control of all federal courts. The only federal court that must exist constitutionally is the Supreme Court. So the Congress could actually decide to eliminate all the circuit courts, all the federal circuit courts around the country. They could reconfigure them any way they choose. They could change the the pay salary and structure for the federal judges on those levels. They could do anything they want. In other words, it is their responsibility to keep a check upon the judiciary, and we're going to study later when we get to Article 3 how they also have a very direct check on the power of the Supreme Court. But here they have a total responsibility for the federal courts. So we hear a hue and cry, and rightly so to a certain degree throughout the country today, that we are under a tyranny of black robe lawyers, that the judges are out of control, particularly the federal judges. And yet we have Congress not willing to step up to the plate and do their duty, which is to control and discipline federal courts when they are out of line, whether with impeachment is obviously one case, but they don't even have to impeach a judge to punish that judge. They can punish him by his salary reduction. They can punish him by moving him off into a backwater or redistricting his, you know, there's 100 ways in which they can punish federal judges who will not abide by the terms of the Constitution. And instead we have ridiculous situations where I think it's the Ninth Circuit Court out there in the West that ruled that saying the Pledge of Allegiance was unconstitutional because it had under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. Well, and then we have the response of Congress kind of wringing their hands saying, oh, what are we going to do about this? You know what? And let's come up with a piece of legislation that says the opposite, that says, well, you know, saying under God in the Pledge of Allegiance is constitutional.
And of course that's ridiculous, because then the court can say, well, it's unconstitutional. And we see this game played over and over again. And Congress, all they have to do is simply enact the legislation and put a rider on it saying the courts cannot intervene in this. But you see, they really don't want to do that. They want to pander to the public and make them feel that, oh, our congressmen are so concerned about God. But it's really not true. It's really all part of this smoke and mirrors, rhetoric over reality, symbolism over substance, that the games that they play in Washington, D.C. to deceive the electorate, and without nobody ever saying Congress could do it if they really wanted to. Well, Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney. And before we go on, David, would you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution and hopefully in their own community set up a institute and begin teaching people in their community about this wonderful Constitution we have?
Yes, Dr. Stan. You know, many people today, conservatives who understand some of these principles, are wringing their hands as they see, you know, the renewal of the Patriot Act and other things like this, and say, is there anything we can do? Is it too late for America? And I say it is not too late for America. What needs to take place is Americans taking action. And the action, the most important action, because the first action that needs to happen is a recovery of our founders' understanding of law and government, a recovery of our understanding of the original intent of the founding documents, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. That's why we put together this course, Institute on the Constitution. And this host kit enables anyone without any background necessarily as a historian or a constitutional law, without any background, to conduct a course. We say it's hosting a course. You're really not teaching it. Dr. John Einsmill, constitutional law professor, does an excellent job in 12 one-half-hour lectures on DVD. You just provide a television and a DVD player so that you can show your group these lectures, and then we have a student notebook that is a detailed outline of each of those lectures, so the student follows along and is able to make their own notes as the lecture unfolds. And then, as the host, we give you a host notebook that gives you the answers to a series of questions that are asked after the lecture's finished. So you review the material by asking a series of questions and helping the students solidify what they heard and understand what they heard. Then there's a test that's offered for the student to take between lectures. So if you're offering your course once a week, that between those times they would take this test on their own, and then you as the host have the answers. So it's a turnkey way in which you can conduct the class that can teach the essentials of American history, the foundation on biblical law, what the original intent of our Declaration, Constitution, Bill of Rights is, and so that they can take their place as citizens who are going to hold elected officials accountable, or recognize perhaps there's no elected official who's willing to follow the Constitution. We need to replace them. We need to put others in their place. And many people have despaired of where we're at in the United States, and yet I have hope because I talked to a host out in Washington today who's conducting a class in which he has three people who are planning to conduct their own classes. So they're spreading the word, and I'm conducting a class here in Maryland right now, and there's three people who are going to conduct classes later in Maryland, and there's also three people who are running for office here for state-held positions as delegates to our state capitol who are taking the course because they want to understand what the original intent was so that they, when they go as a legislator, can act constitutionally.
Well, let's get the telephone number out. Let's get the website out so people will know how to get in touch with you.
Our toll-free number that people can call and order our host kit is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or actually, they could purchase it also on our website. Our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And there's other resources available there in our web store as well as a number of articles. And we're trying to update. Actually, I'm working on putting some of these radio shows, making them available for people to listen from the past archive. And so there's many things that are available there on that website, iotconline.com. But the hope is, as we spread the number of people conducting this class, educate millions of Americans, we can turn our nation around and return to the constitutional republic designed by our founders.
Well, now that you mentioned in Washington, was that in around the Spokane area that they're putting the programs on? Because our programs are heard up in Spokane, and I know we've got a lot of wonderful people up there who are getting pretty well educated about what's going on, and hopefully now they're ready to get involved. It sounds like they really are.
They are.
That's getting excited. Well, basically, David, point number eight was Congress has the right to establish copyright laws. 9, to control the federal courts.
Mm-hmm.
10, pick the story up there.
And as what we talked about previously, punish piracy and felonies on the high seas. Our framers knew the concept of the law of nations, that is God's law, that they established our country upon. Those laws applied to every nation, and therefore they applied to nations when they were out on the sea. So that you did have an international standard, but the international standard was not the UN or some crazy thing like that. No, the international standard was God's law, the same standard upon which they established our constitutional republic. Then we step into numbers 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16, all of which have to do with war. First of all, number 11, it's Congress's duty to declare war. This is extremely important to mention because there has not been a congressionally declared war in our country since World War II. So the Korean War, Vietnam, you list them all the way down to, you know, Iraq I, you could call it Iraq II, whatever you want to call the Persian Gulf Wars. None of these wars have been declared constitutionally. None of them have followed the law required by the Constitution. And there's a reason for why the framers decided that Congress should declare war. If the president, we'll study that in Article 2, the president is the chief executive, was the director, basically, of the military. They did not want it in the power of the one who was the head of the military, the president, to be the one who decides to go to war. That decision had to be in the hands of the Congress, a separate branch of government, a check upon his power as president.
But, of course, we see how this has been totally abandoned, and certainly in the first Gulf War, while President Bush decided to go to war, in the current war, Operation Iraqi Freedom, why it was the president's decision, and you know, the Congress didn't declare war. They sort of gave him permission to do what he had to do to protect America, because after all, Saddam Hussein had those weapons of mass destruction and was going to attack America at any time, and that's why we had to go in there. And so basically what we've done is seen the usurpation of power by the executive branch of government. And now, of course, we see that with the spying, the president says, look, I was elected to protect the American people. I have a right to spy. You know, this is where we're preventing the terrorists from, taking away our freedom. And, of course, what they're really doing, they're not spying on the terrorists, although I'm sure some of them are terrorists, but they're watching the American people and collecting dossiers on them. And this whole issue of terrorism is simply to distract to bear people away from the fact that step by step by step, we're centralizing all power with the executive branch of government, which is what our founding fathers feared, isn't it, David?
That's right. And, you know, people say to me, well, David, it was legal what they did because Congress granted that power to the president. I say, wait a minute. Just because they did it doesn't make it legal. The Constitution is what determines what is legal. They are the only ones that declare war. They cannot cede their power to declare war to another branch of government. They cannot do that because if they do so, they have effectively amended the Constitution without following the procedures that we'll study when we get to Article 5 about how you amend the Constitution. They've done it illegally, and therefore they have broken the law. The president has broken the law, and both of them, what would you call them? You'd call them lawbreakers. They've gotten away with breaking the law because the American people don't know the law, that is the Constitution, to which the elected officials are to be held accountable. Well, in addition to number 11, Congress having only Congress having the power to declare war, it's the next statement in 12 is that Congress has the power to raise and support armies. And it's armies would be a very generic term for all non-naval forces. So today, you know, well, they didn't have an air force in that day. Certainly the air force would fall into the function of the army, and actually it grew out of the army. But it's important to see the details here. It's support armies. That is, armies were to be a temporary gathering of the reserve militia of the individual states. And there was a two-year limitation on funding for the army. In other words, if Congress declared war, say they did declare war in this current, whatever you want to call it, over there in Iraq, current mess in Iraq, suppose they did declare war. Well, 2 years after they declared war, they would have to come back and re-vote on that war. In other words, they only gave 2 years for the war to be conducted before it had to be considered again by Congress, which placed, again, an enormous check upon the powers of war, such that Congress, very answerable to the people in their home legislative districts, if the war was unpopular, if the people didn't want this war taking place, they'd let their congressman know, and 2 years later the congressman either is going to step out of his seat of power and somebody replace him, or he's going to bow to the will of the people regarding a war. So this was a check upon, again, the power for our federal government of going to war. Number 13 relates to this. It says to provide and maintain a navy. And notice a different language, to raise and support armies, because armies were temporary. There was never any intention on our founding fathers' part to have a standing military, a standing army. They recognized that that great evil is what caused many, many of the wars in Europe. That all the potentates of Europe had their standing armies, and a standing army wasn't going to stand around for very long. King was going to use his standing army for some action that the king wanted that may have had nothing to do with what was in the best interest of the people. And the people of Europe suffered war after war after war because of the standing army. So they didn't want a standing army. They only wanted to raise an army, that is, bring together the state militias and form an army when it was absolutely necessary because the country was being attacked or an insurrection was taking place within the country. There was some grave danger to the nation that needed to be addressed. In contrast, however, number 13, provide and maintain for a navy, because they recognize the navy is a much more permanent fighting force. You just can't raise a navy overnight. The ships have to be maintained, and dockyards and all that is involved in a navy requires much more of an ongoing moment-by-moment thing. So the navy would be standing, you know, a standing navy. And that's actually necessary, because if you're going to protect your coast from attack, you need a standing navy to be patrolling your coast and guarding your harbors. And we got this ridiculous thing, I don't know if you've heard about it out there on the West Coast, but they're about to deliver the security of our major ports here, all the major ports on the East Coast, to United Arab Emirates firm that is actually a branch of the government of the United Arab Emirates. So here we're going to give these Arabs control over our ports. Talk about port security, that's ridiculous, but maintaining and providing a navy was about defending and protecting, especially our coastlines. Well then, number 14 comes to providing rules of discipline for military forces. That the Congress is the one that establishes the rules, not the President, it's the Congress. Remember this whole crazy debate back in the Clinton era of don't ask, don't tell. Well, what was going on there is the president was setting up the rules. The president was calling the shots. Well, you know, the military is under my command. I'm the commander-in-chief of the military, and so I can set the rules. No, he can't. That's a violation of the very structure here of the Constitution. It's Congress that sets the rules, and the Congress sees that those rules are followed by the president. The president is enforcing those rules and see that the military follows the rules, but the rules are established by Congress, and they're known as the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Number 15, then, deals with providing for and calling the militia into federal service. You see, the states were to maintain a militia. That is, most of the able-bodied men of 18, 21 may vary from state to state, but the states were to have a militia, to gather their able-bodied men together, to train them in military readiness, and then when was needed, those state militias would be called up into federal service to do three things and three things only: to execute federal laws, to suppress insurrections internally, domestic disturbances, that kind of thing, and to repel invasions. Those are the only three constitutional functions that the Army can engage in. And so why do we have troops now in the, 140 countries of the world? Why do we have troops over there in the Philippines trying to help these people dig out of the mudslide? It's like, is that somehow executing federal laws? Is that suppressing insurrections internally? Is that repelling invasions? No. Most of what our federal army is doing has nothing to do with the constitutional functions that the army is supposed to be doing. They get away with it again because the American people don't know this law. They don't know that they're holding to hold their elected officials accountable to this law. And so whether you agree with a war in Iraq or not, unless it meets that standard, those three things, execute federal laws, suppress insurrections, repel invasions, you got to say, wait a minute, unless Iraq was about to invade us, there's no justification for us to have any of our troops on the ground there in Iraq, let alone the 140 countries of the world where we have troops today in this far-flung empire, for that's truly what it has become. Not at all what our founding fathers designed it to be.
But there were some people who wanted an empire. People like Benjamin Franklin. I remember what he said, you know. The older I am, the more convinced I become of the fact that God rules in the affairs of men, and that if a sparrow cannot fall without his knowledge, can a great empire be raised without his blessing? And there were people like
Alexander Hamilton.
You're right, who wanted an empire. But most Americans did not want an empire then, and we don't want an empire today. But there are people, really, who would use the power of our government to create an empire and force all other nations into their or our way of living. They want to establish democracies throughout the world, and I don't understand that, because America is a republic, not a democracy. So why are we so intent upon bringing democracy to the rest of the world when, of course, as Plato had said so well in his Republic, democracies always deteriorate into despotism? I wish certainly our Congress and our members of our executive would read our Constitution and find out we are not a democracy, we're a republic. Maybe you ought to put on a series of programs for them, David.
Yes, actually, we're praying that the Lord would grant us an opportunity. And there's a new congressman that is a freshman congressman, we've been told, has been given by someone close to her, one of our host kids, and has promised that she is going to sit down with her staff and go through this. And I'm praying that we'll be able to have contact with this congressman and perhaps, you know, do a in-person class rather than just watching videos, be able to go down and help them understand this. And I've had contact with other people who have said they might know some congressional staffers that might be willing to take our class. And I would love to have the opportunity to do that, Dr. Stan, because oftentimes the congressman or the senator, they're just blind to what's going on, and their staff are the ones who actually are the gatekeepers as to which piece of legislation gets considered and which doesn't, and might have a tremendous impact if we could reach even the staff of the congressmen as well as the senators in D.C.
Well, one of the big problems is what you teach is not being taught in our schools, is not being taught in our universities, and as a result, those people who graduate and become congressmen and senators really don't understand the Constitution of the United States. Once again, let's get your telephone number out and your website.
Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. And our website is iotconline.com.
That's iotconline.com. And our guest, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Well, David, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up tonight's program.
Let's finish then the section here that deals with the powers granted to Congress regarding war. The 16th in the list of 18 is to organize, arm, and discipline a militia. Again, the militias were under the control of the individual states, the individual 13 states here as the congressional or the constitutional convention met. And the Congress controls the militia only when it's brought into federal service, only for the three reasons we mentioned: execute federal laws, suppress insurrection, repel invasions. Otherwise, it's the states that are in control of their state militia. And the state reserves the right to appoint the militia officers for its militia. And, of course, those officers are subject to the discipline of Congress and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. But, again, states have an enormous power over their own state militias. Now, today, most state militias are basically a joke. It's it's the weekend warrior kind of thing, and National Guard kind of thing. That people have no sense of the state militias, and because the mockery of the militia movement in America has been so effective in the media, most people think militias are a terrible idea. Well, it's right here in the Constitution. It's very clear that the state militias are supposed to be the basic fighting force, and they're only called up when they're needed for some very extreme reasons. But the states have power over the militia, and the governor has control over the state militia. I remember down one of the battles that was taking place in Alabama over the Ten Commandments monument. Governor Fob James, a great hero of mine, he stood up and said, basically, we're not going to move that Ten Commandments monument. And if the Federals want to come down here with their troops and challenge us to move it, we will meet them at the state borders with the state militia. Because the state militia is not under the control of the federal government. It's under the control of the state of Alabama. And the law of the state of Alabama requires that we defend our state's right to acknowledge God. That is a God-given right that the federal government can't take away. Well, when that governor left office, another wicked governor came in, and surely enough, the Ten Commandments monument was moved.
Well, I'm certainly hoping that we'll have a good governor in Alabama as of November of this year, because Judge Roy Moore is running for the governor of Alabama, and ladies and gentlemen, he deserves our prayers, he deserves our support. He's a courageous man who really believes in the Constitution, who really believes in God, and is led by God to do what he's doing. I just wish we had a few more men like him out there. So I know you're working with Judge Roy Moore, and I want to know that I appreciate everything you and the Institute are doing, and we'll look forward to having you with us again next month.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we certainly look to you out there across America as you listen to our programs to help us as we reach out, try to let people understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. Now, those of you who have heard me talk about it before, I want to mention that there are two forces in America. One is the Christian, the other is the occult. The background of this is beautifully laid out in a recent DVD put together by a good friend called Chris Pinto, entitled The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. And Chris has put out other excellent DVDs. One was Megiddo 1, and it is the story of America and the prophecies, the false prophets and then the true prophets about what would happen in times like this. The second is Megiddo 2, and I play a part in that as we take you to the Georgia Guidestones and other occult areas in this country. But the last production, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, actually explains to you exactly what's happening and how back in the 1600s, members of a British secret society called the Rosicrucians came to the United States. Their goal was to establish a one-world government. Their goal was to reestablish the lost Atlantis and then to use the military and financial power of the United States to bring about a world government. And that is exactly what's going on today. Why is the United States going to attack Iran? Well, after all, they're trying to develop nuclear weapons. Well, just to the south of them is Pakistan. They have nuclear weapons. To the east of them is China. They have nuclear weapons. To the north of them is Russia, and they have nuclear weapons. But we're worried about Iran having nuclear weapons. Has Iran threatened to bomb the United States to nuke Los Angeles as China did? Of course not. What they're doing is manipulating the American people into another war. Only this war, I fear, will provoke and inflame the anger of the entire world Muslim population and will lead to World War III. And there really are people who want that sort of thing. This is what's so incredible. There are people who look at the world through far different eyes than you and I do. If you'd like to know how to get the items we've mentioned, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, but specifically The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, an excellent DVD, almost 3 hours, and I'll have to admit I do play a small part in that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to learn more about that, if you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters and know more about our ministry. You can certainly go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And there you can listen to our archive programs on the Internet. You can listen to them regular, or you can listen to them on MP3. You can listen to the live programming as well. And then, of course, we do programs on the Genesis Network, on the Republic Network, and then on the American Freedom Network. So you can get the addresses of all of those sites there. We are available on shortwave and on the satellite as well, especially Telstar 5. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our program and explain to them that we're involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Please pray for America and pray for revival, because if America doesn't turn back to God, God will turn his back on America. And please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Dan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we certainly welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls and don't call in unless we specifically do ask for calls, because, well, this evening we have with us one of my favorite guests, Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. Hi, Bob. How are we doing?
Pretty good. Pretty good. No complaints this evening.
Well, some exciting things are in the offing, and certainly a lot of questions that you've even raised. You know, in your newsletter, you commented that some strange things were happening as far as the Swiss banks, and they weren't accepting checks from Americans, or they were holding up the checks, or cashier's checks, things of that sort. And you said you were going to try to find out what this was, and it was so unusual that Swiss banks wouldn't accept American checks for holding them for 60 days. Did you ever find out what that was all about?
Well, thus far, what I have found is that the Swiss banks and the German banks have been instructed by the U.S. government to hassle people who are using American checks over there, even though they're businessmen. Evidently, in Europe, for some time, England, Holland, France as well, that they have been taking anywhere up to 3 months to clear a check. And so what they're trying to do is drive people to use larger denominations and use wire transfers. And the reason I want that is that wire transfers are extremely easy to trace. And they've had a setup to intercept wire transfers since 1985, which is 20 years, in Zurich. They took over a bank there that was run by a friend of mine who was long since retired, and he sold his bank out to the U.S. government, and they're using it as a front. And not many people know that. I just happened to know him simply because I knew this man very, very well for many, many years. I used to live in Switzerland. And so what they're trying to do is force transfers by wire so they can keep track of what everybody's doing. And they don't want people cashing checks anywhere for that matter.
All right, fine. So there's nothing more sinister than that. They're just trying to be able to track all money as they're doing everything. They're simply trying to set up dossiers on every American citizen. Isn't that true?
Yes, it is. And they're demanding that every government do that, as well as turn over any information which they have on Americans that have any kind of business interest in a country.
And my understanding, though, is that a lot of these banks and a lot of the people throughout the rest of the world are getting pretty sick of the Americans just telling them what to do. Is that true?
Right, but there's not a lot they can do about it. It takes a pretty strong president, and you have to have kind of an ace in the hole in order to combat them.
All right, hold that. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman, right here at the American at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. Well, tell us, what is the latest thing? It looks to me like, you know, that certainly what they're beginning to do, I read an article by Ambrose Evans Pritchard today. He said that the carrying trade is going to begin to drop off, that they're going to begin to stop this extremely or ridiculously low lending process, and where you can borrow money in Japan for no interest rate at all and then lend it in the United States and get 2 or 3%. They're going to begin changing a lot of these things. Is that true?
Well, I'll tell you what's happening. The Japanese have had interest rates of 0.5% or 1%, which is virtually nothing. And the reason I've done that is that they have been in a depression since 1991. And it was the only way that they could keep their economy afloat. In fact, their debt to GDP is something on the order of 250. A normal debt to GDP would be somewhere around 30 or 40. So you can see how strung out they are. But anyway, the Japanese economy is starting to recover. They're starting to have more inflation than they've had before, which was almost zero. And so what they're going to do is they're going to raise interest rates, and that in turn is going to make the Japanese yen stronger. Now, what hedge funds and other professionals do is they go to Japan and they purchase yen and purchase it by borrowing it. They take the yen and they convert it into another currency, usually dollars. And they might buy U.S. treasuries, or they might go in the American stock market, or they might do a number of things with the money. It affects all markets.
Now, is that what you call the carriage trade?
This is the carry trade.
Right, okay.
And so if the value of the yen increases, when they go to pay the yen back, they're going to have to give more yen perhaps than, you know, for the yen than perhaps they paid for it when they borrowed it in the first place. And they have certain parameters for guaranteed gains, and that's the only chink in the armor, and that would be fighting a appreciating currency. That just happened with the Icelandic dollar, which I won't get into here because it's a whole different kind of story. But there's carry trades in many things.
Hold that. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob Chapman was just explaining the term, the carry trade. I was reading an article by Ambrose Evans Pritchard today, and he was talking about the carry trade and how it was, for instance, in Japan, you could borrow money for 0.5% interest, and then you could come into the United States and take that money that you'd gotten, borrowed in yen, and convert it into dollars, bring them to the United States, and buy T-bonds at, what do they get, 2 or 3, 4% here for the T-bonds?
If you're buying two-year paper, it's about 4.72.
Okay, so you can borrow at 0.5% and then lend it at 4.72. That's pretty good spread.
Well, you know what they also do? They give up 0.5 point and they buy derivatives, which guarantees them no risk on the bond and just the net yield. And they do the same thing on the other side with the yen. So they're trying to cage in a net 3%, let's say. And that's the way it works. The problem is that the currencies can get out of range if they appreciate too much. And it would be better for them if the yen depreciated. But, you know, that isn't what's happening right now. And so what does that do? It affects all of the markets in the world, and particularly the U.S. stock market. There's a realization now that there's going to be a big unwinding of the yen trade, and there's going to be a rush to get out the door. And, of course, everybody can't fit through the door at the same time, and so that means that there's going to be serious losses taken by some players who didn't insure themselves or protect themselves.
And, of course,
that is going to raise havoc with the New York Stock Exchange listings, the Dow Jones, the S&P, and so on. It's also going to affect other forex markets in other currencies. To some extent, it'll affect gold and silver, dependent upon how much of the carry trade money has gone in there. Very little, I believe, but some has. And it's going to be a very disjointing event, and it could be the catalyst for the untoward event, which I talk about in the International Forecaster, that you don't know what's coming, and all of a sudden it comes, and everything changes, and what we've been talking about of financial and monetary problems throughout the world click into place, and the bad news all hits at once, and problems become reality.
Oh, are you anticipating then there could be a further fall in the stock market? And what about gold and silver stocks? Would they tumble right along with the mainland stocks?
Well, first of all, no. Gold and silver stocks are a recipient of a gold and silver bull market, so they're not going to be affected like that unless the carry trade was doing that, but I don't think so. The markets are too small. The total capitalization is about $120 billion on gold and silver stocks. These are in the top 20 companies. That's one-third or one-half of the value of General Electric. And so it's infinitesimal. So those kind of players don't do too much in that market, and nor do they do an awful lot in the gold and silver market. But they do something, but we don't know how much yet. We're going to find out. But the real markets are going to get hit as other foreign exchange markets and the large stock exchanges. And that's why you saw the Dow down over 100 points today. In spite of the fact that the repo pull by the Fed is right near its all-time high.
Now, by repo, I mean this is the money that the Fed is putting out to try to manipulate the stock market and keep it up?
They had $114 billion today that they had in play with their 21 agents, which gives them intraday buying power of about $170 billion. And if you put that together with the $400 to $500 billion, we'll say $450 billion, that the working group in financial markets has, you're looking close to $600 to $650 billion to manipulate the market during the course of the day.
And do you think that this just got away from them today? Is that why it fell off 100 points?
No. I think that they did their best to keep it up. They weren't powerful enough. And there's a lot of professionals getting out of the market. And they know trouble's coming. And they only can do so much. And things are changing. People who are in the stock market, got mutual funds, get out. Just like I told everybody previous to last June, that the real estate market was going to top out in the next 3 or 4 months, and it has done that. In fact, the month that really showed the top of the market was September, and it's continuing to go down. Inventories are building, etc. I'm pretty well on top of this, and I'm usually right.
Well, what about if you were to invest in gold and silver stocks right now, where would you be putting your money?
Gold and silver stocks, gold and silver coins.
Gold and silver stocks.
And gold and silver coins.
Okay, fine. But, I mean, which ones do you think are the best one, best bets? And certainly, we know that you think gold and silver coins are important, and I certainly agree with that. Even though I'm not a financial advisor, I've been watching these things for a long time. But if you were going to go into the gold stocks, or would you go into gold stocks right now? Would you sort of sit on the sidelines and wait to see what happens if we have a shakeout?
You don't wait. You buy. And this is a great time to buy. And it's going to be a great time for a long time. We haven't even finished phase one of a 3 or 4 phase bull market in both metals. I'm looking for gold to go to an absolute minimum of $1,700 an ounce. And it closed today, I don't know, 560, something like that. And silver, I don't know where it's going, but it's going up because there's a shortage of inventory. And it always moves with inflation. We are going to get hyperinflation. And we're going to go into a depression where we have hyperinflation. It's going to be unbelievable.
What was you really talking about?
In the 1930s, Stan, we didn't have hyperinflation. We went into a depression, and that was bad. Now, going into a depression with hyperinflation an enormous debt that nobody can pay.
They're really talking about an inflationary depression.
Exactly.
And that is the worst of all worlds. That's the worst of all worlds. Well, which specific are you in a position to say which specific, gold stocks would you think? Would you think things like Agrico Eagle or Newmont, or what would you think?
All right, first of all, I don't like Newmont. Their earnings came in, they were terrible. Their costs are way up. American Barrick, I don't like either. They're offside about $5.5 billion with the hedge positions. The ones I do like are Agnico Eagle, Gold Corp, Crystal X. That's on the American Stock Exchange. Silver Standard, which is trades over the counter. And two exploratory stocks I like, Northmont Mining and Rainy River, and they both trade on Vancouver. I usually don't recommend stocks on the embassy, and you asked, those are the ones I personally like. As far as coins are concerned, I like numismatic coins, the graded coins, the common coins. MS64 St. Gaudens are my favorite. And silver, I like silver bags. They're the best buy, and they may become numismatic because most of them have melted down.
Well, now, my understanding is the dealers can still get the bags of silver coins. Do you anticipate that one of these days soon they're not going to be available?
I think that's going to be the case. I really do. I think 95% of them have been melted. And what 5% is, I don't know. But the public in America, in Europe, and Canada are not in the gold and silver markets in any way. Now, when they do come in, after we pass 850 on gold, they're going to be looking for product. And the best buy has in silver is in those, what they call junk coins, 90% silver coins, which were in circulation prior to 1964. And so that possibility does exist that there wouldn't be any available. And incidentally, last time around, you know, I've been in these markets since 1960, and during the late 70s, when the MS64, that's what it's called today, St. Gaudens was $500, gold was selling for approximately $425 or something like that. When gold was selling at $850, that coin was $5,000. So it went from $500 to $5,000. The silver coins and silver went bananas, and silver went up to $50. And I think that it can do that again, and it might do much more than that. Because what happens is that once the public comes into the market from Europe, Canada, and the United States, and they're not in any way in there, once they come in, they're going to bid everything up. And gold is going to fly, the coins will fly, the stocks will fly. And the stocks, Coeur d'Alene last time around, went from 30 cents to $23. East Rand Proprietary and Durban Deep went from 30 cents to $52 and $55. And in the 1930s, Homestake went from $6 to $636, so it's going to be big money made.
Well, is Coeur d'Alene still a pretty good stock?
Yeah, it's only in New York. It's just not in my top picks.
Okay. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment. With what about Phelps Dodge? Is that a play at all?
Well, I think copper is going to continue to do well at least through the end of the year. And Phelps Dodge has run into a number of problems, so I'd go to the smaller producers or go to the exploration companies.
Okay, hold on. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. Now, we see this continued drain of American jobs, of American factories, of America's wealth into other countries as part of this process of globalization. There's no way this can continue indefinitely, and we can maintain our standard of living, is there?
Well, you're right, but somebody ought to tell Congress. Now, the problem with Congress is everybody's paid off except for a handful of people. And it's just as simple as that. The criminality is probably the worst that's ever been experienced in this country in politicians. I mean, you've seen the scandals one after another. Corporate scandals, Wall Street scandals, banking scandals, insurance scandals. Nobody goes to jail practically. I mean, it's got to be a heinous case. Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and BNA, all three of them get dinged for over $3 billion that they stole, that they defrauded from their clients. And nobody went to jail. They just paid the fines. And, of course, the shareholders are the ones that paid those fines. And that's the tenor of what's going on out there. In Congress, you know, how do they get paid off? They get campaign contributions. They get money through PACs. Their friends and their relatives get jobs. And after they are no longer in office, a nice, cushy, lobbying job is arranged for them, like Bob Dole, who just was hired by Dubai Ports, that sort of thing. And they all get taken care of. Look at Alan Greenspan. He retired. He made three speeches. He's already made $1 million.
Gee, must be a pretty good speaker. No, I realize this is simply a video. It's simply a payoff, and we've seen this with so many congressmen and so many senators and so many presidents. And even Gorbachev, gets his share, $100,000 a speech, things of that sort.
Yeah, well, he's financed by the Rockefellers.
I'm not at all surprised.
The foundation is bankrolled by other foundations.
All right, well, certainly we see the stock market took a tumble today. Do you think the stock market is going to make a major move downward at the present time, or do you think they'll be able to hold it up temporarily for another 3-6 months, a year?
It's too hard to guess. All I can tell you is it's coming. You don't want to be there. I don't think it's going to stop at 7268 on the Dow. I think in the next few years, we could see it down at 42 to 4,500. And other professionals I know think it could go lower than that. We are facing a financial, monetary, and economic crisis that's never been seen in modern history. Modern history will say since the 19th century, the evolution of our banking systems as they are today. And this is going to be a humdinger. And the public just doesn't have a clue and doesn't want to know.
Well, I think nobody likes to know that they have cancer. Nobody likes to hear bad news. Nobody likes to hear that the body politic is sick, but it really is.
Unfortunately so, and you and I spent all this time trying to reach lost souls, but we reached them. And better we should help people and stand by and do nothing.
Well, at least we have a voice, and that voice certainly is growing, and of course, programs we do are heard. This evening program to be heard on about 30 stations across America. It's small, but it's a growing number, growing audience. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Bob Chapman, and if you would like to call Bob, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we're talking about what's really going on as far as the markets are concerned. And certainly we've seen gold and silver and platinum really do very well. What do you think about palladium? Do you think that palladium could take a good move?
It's a commercial metal. It's already moved up from lower levels. The reason for that is that the Chinese are not wanting to pay for the price of platinum, which is very high, have gone to palladium jewelry. They like the white, so to speak, colored jewelry. You can get the same effect with white gold. And I prefer that personally. But that's where the demand for the palladium is coming from. Automobile production and truck production are down, and I think they're going to continue to move down. And the major use is in catalytic converters. And as that happens, demand will fall, and I think it will put somewhat of a cap on those two metals over a period of time. I, I think that their popularity will wane, and I think they're both overpriced presently.
All
right. And of course, they haven't had a gold cartel suppression group, central banks, if you may, pushing them down like gold and silver have. And so I believe that the big rush of money is going to be into gold and silver.
Well, now, a lot of people will say that silver, the price of silver may very well not drop if we go into a deflation, because silver is an industrial metal, unlike gold. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think I answered that question in saying we're going to have hyperinflation during a depression. And if we do, then silver will continue to be a good investment. But the minute that deflation shows that it's shown up, it's here, it's going to happen, then not only do you want to be out of silver, platinum, palladium, but out of all commodities as well, and only in gold. And at that point in time, you want to switch from numismatic coins to gold bullion coins, because you can take all that profit and get more bang for the proceeds, we'll call it, with those bullion coins. And that's what I anticipate happening.
All right, fine. Well, right now we've got Mike calling us from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Mike, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, thank you for opening the phone line. The question I have is, you're talking about the stock market, and I'm sure I, like a lot of other listeners, are in 401ks that are tied to our employment. And wanting to move out of the 401k, the only way that we would be able to access our money is to terminate our employment. Is there creative ways of maybe borrowing against that, or converting the 401k into like a Goldcorp stock that you know of?
Or maybe an IRA or something like
that. You know, every one of these is different. And, you know, I don't know what your options are within your plan. And, you know, if you, first of all, you've got to find out what you can and you can't do. And then if you want to get a hold of me, I'll try to be helpful. We have a toll-free number. And everybody can get a copy of the International Forecaster. It comes out in email form weekly, twice a month in hard copy. It's about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues. And you can call toll-free to 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. And I answer all calls. You just leave your number, or if you want to email me, you can do that at international_ is like a dash, but it's lower down, it's like a line on a line. So it's international_forecaster, forecaster at yahoo.com. And so you can, you know, get a hold of me and I'll try to help you with it.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
No, sir. Thank you for taking the call.
Okay, fine. And certainly, Bob's an excellent source of information, so I hope you'll take him up on that. And we'll be right back here in just a moment to discuss more about what's going on today. And our guest is certainly Bob Chapin from the International Forecaster. I'm concerned that we're entering very, very difficult times. It's interesting that the Icelandic currency dropped 8% here just in this last couple of days, which had a tremendous impact upon another number of other currencies, and maybe when we get back, my Bob can talk about that aspect of another crisis in the world monetary system. You're not hearing about the regular channels. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest Bob Chapman. Bob, what's the significance of the drop in the Icelandic currency? And was that an 8% drop?
That's correct. And that is kind of a classic. I think people will look back at that and show you how excesses can sometimes really work out perfectly. They borrowed yen. They bought the Icelandic currency with the yen, they being hedge funds for the most part. And what happened was that the yield on the Icelandic currency increased because the value of the currency increased. And so what happened was that the people who did that got an added bonus. Well, with the yen carry trade starting to be terminated, people sold their Icelandic currency and thereby driving it down. And they bought back the yen that they had borrowed. And it wasn't only the Icelandic currency, it spread to Brazil, New Zealand, several other currencies, and that had been highly hedged, highly purchased by hedge funds with borrowed money, particularly yen. And so it could spread to other currencies as well, and it could and probably will spread to other stock exchanges. It might even affect the commodity market. Now, the commodity market has come down quite a bit. In fact, for the year so far, it's down now, whereas it just recently was up. And I think maybe hedge funds that had borrowed yen were in that market and were exiting to buy their yen back, and that's affected that. So, you know, these hedge funds have hundreds of millions of dollars, millions, and they are distorting all the markets. They're unregulated, they're offshore, and the banking community in the United States and the politicians don't want to do anything about it because most of the people who are in hedge funds are very wealthy, and so they want to let them do what they want to do, and I don't think that's a good idea.
What do you think that this could eventually impact on the American dollar and the value of the American dollar as well?
I think it will, because I think people have gone long over the past year, the American dollar, and used the yen carry trade.
Hold that thought.
And
we'll be right back.
I think it's only...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bob Chapman from the International Forecaster. And then, of course, Bob was talking about the Icelandic currency. And what had happened was that people had actually borrowed the yen, which you can get at 0.5%, and then they'd bought Icelandic currency and, of course, bonds or something, and they were getting a pretty good return on that. That drove up the price of the Icelandic currency. And then, of course, when the value of the yen began to rise, they had to pay back what they had borrowed. They had to sell their Icelandic currency or their bonds there and then buy the yen back. And all of a sudden, in just a day or two, the value of the Icelandic currency dropped 8% because there were so many people were pulling their money out of Iceland, and that had that spread to a number of other countries. And so this happened just in the last few days, Bob?
Well, it started last week. One of the other things is that Moody's downgraded the country's credit rating, and that kind of got things kicked off, and that made a lesser investment, so to speak. And so, you know, that helped get things going. And, you know, sometimes an untoward event like that can create havoc in a number of places unexpectedly. It's just like inflation in America. Inflation, and I've talked to other experts about this, other economists, and inflation, we argue about it, it's between 8% and 10%, and it's rising. The government admits to 4%. I just wrote an article today, it'll be in the next issue of the International Forecaster, explaining all about that and how the government gives us bogus figures on inflation, which is CPI, and also on unemployment and many other things. And it just isn't the Bush administration. It started with Carter. It really was made a fine art by the Clinton administration. And every, you know, political group that's been in power has used it. And the American people are getting cheated.
Well, now, what about the value of our debt? It certainly is. Is it considered stable? I mean, we're the greatest debtor nation in the world today. I would think that people would be scared to death to invest in the United States. We may be the most mighty army and military power, but certainly our economic situation, the foundation upon which our military is built, is really so vulnerable today. At least this is my impression. And I know I've read articles by, say, Osama bin Laden, and I hate to quote Osama, but he commented on how fragile our economic system was. How the Arabs could, and the terrorists could never consider defeating us militarily, but economically, they could topple the structure of our society. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, there is, and Iran's making a step forward. Of course, they have neutralized the so-called nuclear preparation problem with the United States and Great Britain by making a deal with Russia to commercially enrich uranium for them. But what they're doing is they're opening up an oil bourse where oil will be traded in euros, and that's going to open up in this coming month, which begins tomorrow. I think the date is the 16th. And at the same time, the Federal Reserve has said that they're not going to print the money supply figures anymore. And the reason they don't want to do that is because they're going to have to inflate wildly just to keep this economy from collapsing, and we go, everybody goes. And so we're facing things are coming to a head, and how far away we are from cataclysmic events remains to be seen. I cover it deeply in this next issue of the International Forecaster in simple English, so you can understand what it take you 50 years of learning, which I've had in studying this. You'll know it all in 2 hours when you read the Forecaster.
All right, well, we'll look forward to getting it. I always look forward to getting what you write, Bob. Now, certainly, my concern is that, you know, if America starts getting into trouble financially, the whole world is going to get into trouble financially because we are the engine that's maintaining the economy of the rest of the world. And how long can they keep us going simply by continuing to pour out more and more money? And certainly, there's going to be ways of getting the M3 figures that they're not going to print. They say, oh, it's so expensive, oh, it's just so much trouble, oh, shucks. But the truth of the matter is, they don't want the American people or the other central banks of the world to know how they're destroying the value of our currency. I've heard that, that many members of the Federal Reserve Board are thinking of resigning. Have you heard that?
Yes, out of seven, four have resigned in the last year. And, of course, Mr. Greenspan ended his tenure. And there have been a number of changes at regional banks as well. Nobody wants to be in there when it hits the fan.
You think with the rodents?
And nobody wants to be holding the bag, so to speak.
Are the rodents leaving the vessel?
Yes, exactly. The rodents are leaving the vessel. And Bernanke has to be out of his mind. The game's over. There's not much more they can do except print money and extend credit, and that isn't going to work. You see, they're in uncharted waters. In the early 1930s, they cut back on money supply and credit, and they say that had they not done that, they being the Fed, that the Depression wouldn't have been nearly as bad as it was, but they don't know because they hadn't tried flooding the economy with money and credit. And we're going to find out if it'll work. And I want to tell you something. I've read history going back to the 12th century, and I want to tell you that this is nothing new. It's been done over and over and over again, and they know it.
I mean, it happened in ancient Greece, it happened in ancient Rome. I mean, it's happened dozens of times, during the last century. They know it's going to happen. We saw what happened in Germany in the 1930s that led, of course, to the Third Reich. And it was really the inflation of the 1920s and the total destruction of German society that led to them to be willing to accept the leadership of the Führer.
Hitler was born at Versailles, and the concept of nationalist fascism, national socialism as it was called. And the key was the reparations. And those reparations kept Germany in such a state in the early 1920s that in order to pay them, what they had to do was to print money wildly. And that depression and that printing, what it did was create the environment for somebody like Hitler to come to power. And of course, he was financed by internationalist elitist interests in Germany, in England, in the United States, and they were their bankers. In fact, the Bush family was involved. And so that's the evolution of that. And we're facing somewhat similar. As you, as a reader of the publication, know, that I call the government which we have in America today a corporatist fascist government, and that's exactly what we've got.
All right, well, what somebody had called in didn't want to come in the air, but they wanted to know which gold bullion coins you'd recommend. Were you recommending the St. Gaudian? And what about the rating on the other? They have MS 46 and 40, I don't know what it is.
Well,
I guess
from 61 through 67.
All right.
And but in the bullion coins, I mean, take your choice. I mean, you got Mexico Centenarios, which are over an ounce. You've got American Eagles, you've got Maple Leafs from Canada, the Krugerrand from South Africa, and on and on and on. You've got to talk to the dealer, and you have to decide what you want. I mean, when the bullion coins first started to trade in the early 1970s, I got a Hungarian 1 ounce, I forget what they're called, and I had it set for my wife in gold as a necklace. But, you know, it all depends on what you like.
All right, fine. But do you think that the St. Gaudians, the MS 61 through 65 are basically a good investment at the present time? Would you rather be in those simply than in bullion coins?
I prefer them personally.
All right, fine. Now, of course, what's going to happen as far as India and China and some of these other countries? I mean, you're talking about India and China. Between them, they have well over 2 billion people, close to 2.5 billion people. That's almost half the world's population. You know, if they actually went on to the gold standard, they would destroy the American currency. And China has so much American money. They've got about $800 billion in reserves, most of that in American dollars. And, of course, they're over here buying up all sorts of our mortgages, house mortgages that are put together and for sale, and they're buying American bonds. But aren't we becoming totally dependent upon financing by communist China? What sort of insanity is that?
It is insanity, and we are, as well as to Japan and the United Kingdom. They're the biggest holders, and what they call the offshore banks in the Caribbean are big holders as well. But those are the biggies. And yes, we're in a position where we have this tremendous debt. The only way we can go about handling it is to renege on it. We can't pay it back. We can't even pay our own fiscal debt back. And eventually it's going to drive interest rates up, even during an inflationary period. And it's going to drive the value of the dollar down. In fact, Goldman Sachs, which is part of the conspiracy, came out like 2 weeks ago and said the dollar's going to drop 50%. I've been saying it for the last 4 or 5 years, and everybody thought I was insane, and I'm not. I'm usually right. In fact, I saw another person. It was Elizabeth Dole said the other day she thought the dollar would get down 30%. So it's going to go down. It's not going to stay up. It can't.
But, of course, Bob, this means that the people have spent their whole life working, you know, for a pension, for an annuity, for the monies in bonds or bank deposits or any fixed asset, they're all going to lose a significant part of what they spent their whole life working for.
Well, that's why we're on the air, Stan, to help the people who are fortunate enough to listen in to get the straight scoop on what's going on in simple English so that they can save their assets. If you can just keep together what you've got and survive, you're going to be doing something that most all other people are not. Only 5% of Americans will keep their assets together. Everybody else is going to lose assets in varying amounts. And, you know, Americans today have most of their money in their real estate. 69% of Americans on real estate, and it's appreciated quite a bit. Only 46% of people are now presently in the stock market. And so when real estate comes down, which it must, and how much it's going to come down, I don't know, but my guess is in the hot markets at least 40%. There's going to be a rude awakening. And that's why you need to get into gold and silver-related assets now.
All right, and so as far as the silver, you mentioned a couple of silver mines that you thought were pretty good. Silver Standard is, what about Pan American Silver?
Pan American's a good company. I just don't like the management there as well as I do with Silver Standard. Silver Standard's outstanding. Not only do they have the best inventory of properties, but I've known Bob for like 35, 40 years, and he has waited to go into production until silver looked like it was going to fly. And finally, during this year and next year, they'll start to come into production at the perfect time. A lot of people have been producing silver and losing money. Well, there's no sense in that. But, you know, people who run companies do that because they want to get a salary. They want to get a check every week or month, whatever.
Whatever happened to Sunshine Mine? I remember 20 years ago, that was the big silver mine.
Yeah, well, it was their assets were taken over. And the Untermeyer family ran that company into the ground. I remember in 68, I took down half of their bond issue personally for my clients when I was a broker. And everybody thought I was insane, and at that time, the stock was $14, and when the stock was selling at $60, it was a convertible debenture. The bonds were sky high. I was a superhero, you know. And then, of course, in 69, when the market went down, gold and silver shares went down. And, of course, at that time, gold wasn't trading freely. And that didn't happen until a couple of years later. I guess there's a great help having been in these markets for so many years and having a good memory. I can remember everything, and I know how it works, and I know what's going to happen.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that at one time, of course, America was the major foundation of the world monetary system, but now, of course, many of these other countries are coming online, and certainly the countries of South America are increasingly anti-American in Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela and Bolivia, and they're all going to form a big, massive cartel against us economically. My concern is this could have a very real impact upon America. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know something, you're right, but a good part of that is because of this administration. And it's been in office now, and it will be for 8 years in total. They represent the brutality of the excesses of capitalism. In Latin America, the countries have been looted for centuries, and they're just sick and tired of it. And they have leftist politicians coming to power in all of these countries, perhaps except for one in Peru, and the next president of Mexico will be López Obrador, who's a socialist. And why? Because we created the situation. We got people so mad that they'll vote for anybody who will save them from America, from being looted.
What a sad commentary that is. But unfortunately, anybody who's read the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. I don't agree with him on everything, but I think the way the system works, he's laid out very, very well. We even have a set of interviews with him called Economic Hitman. But have you read that book, Bob?
No, I haven't.
It's probably, it just talks
I
about...
I wish I had time to do that.
I know. Hey, hang on. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. And our guest is Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and right now we have Ed from Idaho on. Ed, did you have a quick question for our guest?
Yes, I actually had a comment for you, Dr. Stan. You asked about the Sunshine Mine, and it's up here in my neck of the woods, and because of what I do, my occupation, I call on them periodically. They're trying to reopen.
Are they still around? I mean, their stock just went down to just about nothing, didn't it?
Well, yeah, it did, but they're under new management, and they're trying to raise capital to get the mine going.
All right, fine. Who are they now?
I honestly don't have the name off the tip of my tongue.
Well, we get it for you. Anyway, do you have a question at all for our
guest? I just wanted to make that comment.
All right, well, I appreciate that, and I've often wondered what happened.
That's great input. Thank you.
But maybe you can find the name for us, because it really was an excellent mine years ago.
Well, I can find the name of the company for you, and I'll call you back.
All right, fine. We'll appreciate that. Thanks so very much, Ed.
Looking forward to the next copy of the Forecaster, too, Bob.
Well, Ed, I don't know if you look forward to it as much as I do, but it usually comes in either on Saturday or Sunday, and then I've got to spend a couple of hours reading it, but it's just packed full of so much information.
Takes me a whole day.
God bless. Bye-bye, Ed. Bye. Thanks so much. And that was Ed calling from up in the Idaho area. Well, we've got about a minute for you to wrap up this evening's program, Bob. About a minute and a half. What message do you want to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, there's two things. Number one, get out of debt. Credit card debt, especially revolving debt, and car debt, vehicle debt. And the reason why is that when things get bad and one of you loses your job in the next couple of years, maybe you'll be able to keep your house. I see another battle royal coming up between the states and the federal government and Congress, because all of the changes that they're making in the budget, they're cutting off all domestic spending. And one of the things that they refuse to fund is the new driver's licenses, which is going to cost billions of dollars for the states, and they're mandated by Congress. We could have a situation where the states just simply refuse to do it.
Well, I think it's about time the states said, we're not going to put up with your foolishness. Now the federal government, after instituting all the Medicaid programs, is beginning to cut back on it and saying to the states, it's your problem. And the trouble is that many of our states are in real financial problems, especially with their pension funds, and as their income decreases with the deflation, there's going to be real problems. Bob Chapman, it's been a real pleasure having you with us, and I will be getting in touch with you. We'll schedule our programs for next month.
Okay.
It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we really depend upon those of you out there in the listening audience to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, try to educate people, try to warn them that difficult times lie ahead. Difficult times politically, difficult times financially, difficult times spiritually. And God does bring his vengeance upon nations that turn against him, especially those nations that have been greatly blessed. And is there any nation that's been more greatly blessed than the United States? Is there any nation that has more violently turned against God in recent centuries than the United States, which was once, I believe, the apple of God's eye? He had given us so much. We were truly, at one time, a Christian nation, but who would accuse us of being a Christian nation today? As you watch our television and see the actions of so much of what's going on and of our politicians and even of our people, there was a time when a man's word was as good as his bond, but that no longer is the case. So our plea to you is understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And then, of course, we do hope that many of you out there will give a serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And if you'd like to do that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, please, consider getting some of the material we have. Go to our website, RadioLiberty.com. You can see it all there, but, of course, you have this wonderful new DVD. It's called The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. We have the DVD on The Brotherhood of Darkness. We have the DVD and or video entitled A Planned Population Reduction, and I've had a number of people comment on that. It's the story of the fact that there is an organized effort to eliminate billions of people in the world, and people say that could not be true. I refuse to believe it. Well, we only ask you, of course, to look at the documentation and decide for yourself if it really could be true. That's the planned population reduction, and then, of course, we certainly have my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. We have a little set of pamphlets we've put together called The Occult Hierarchy. Is there really some force that works behind the scenes? Is there really a conspiracy? And I will tell you, there is a conspiracy against God. It has been here since the beginning of time, and there are men who are in contact with another dimension. There are men who are in contact with the masters of wisdom, the ancients, the Great White Brotherhood, the Elder Brothers, and, of course, we've even got books written by them, and many of them today are actually gathering in Henderson, Nevada, because they believe the master, Maitreya, is coming back again. And just as the Christian waits for the Messiah, and the Muslim waits for the Mahdi, and the Hindu waits for Maitreya, and the Jew waits for the Messiah, so I believe a world leader is coming. I believe eventually, of course, Jesus Christ will come forth, but I think before then we're going to see some terrible, terrible, terrible times. So I simply ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. Remember our telephone number? It's 1-800-544-8927. Our website, RadioLiberty.com.